Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, the most popular movie talk radio show on the internet. Now in color. Tonight, he's the Edgar Award-winning and Pulitzer Prize-nominated author who's had 17 of his books adapted into unforgettable feature films, including Death Wish and the new Kevin Bacon film Death Sentence. Multi-talented author, screenwriter, and musician Brian Garfield. Plus, she's the co-star of last week's number one film in America and one of the most buzzed-about films of the year from Halloween actress Christina Klebe. Have a question for the geeks or tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477. Now, dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
How you doing, everybody? This is Movie Geeks United for Sunday evening. My name is Jamie, and I am here with fellow movie geek Jerry. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up, everyone?
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. We've had a very good weekend here at Movie Geeks United, where we've welcomed just over 6,000 new listeners. Just astounding.
Astounding is no. I don't know what word I would use to describe it, but I was in shock when you called me yesterday.
Yeah.
Still am in shock.
It's been a big week for Movie Geeks United, and it's getting bigger next week. Got a great show planned for you tonight. And then Wednesday, we have Joe Pantoliano, Joey Pants, from the new film Canvas, which is a movie I've seen. And it's a big audience favorite. It's played at festivals across the country, and it's a movie that a lot of people believe in. Joe Pantoliano actually produced the film as well as stars in it. And it's a very dear film to his heart. He'll be with us with the director of that film, Joseph Greco, on Wednesday night, and the director of a new movie, a horror film called Hatchet. Have you heard about this movie?
Yeah, it's very popular. It's in limited release right now, and a couple of our friends from Movie Geeks United have seen it and have only had good things to say about it, so hoping it gets a wider release.
I just read the scope of great reviews from, you know, reputable papers on this movie, and it's very odd to find, you know, the horror movie, the horror genre tends to be kind of looked down upon by the critical masses.
It doesn't even get screened the day it's released, so.
Yeah. So we really look forward to speaking with him Wednesday night also. And there's a possibility that we might have on Christy Jacobson, the director of the upcoming documentary Toots. We missed out on her last Wednesday, so I think we're making up for it this Wednesday. But just stay tuned for that confirmation. What have you been up to today, Jerry?
Today I've just been catching up on a lot of news, reading the paper, and reading all about, online at least, about the Venice Film Festival winners.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that a little later, because our man Brian De Palma got...
He scored big.
Yeah, he did. Today's been odd for me. I've been switching between NFL football and a Barry Manilow concert on television. That's I'm probably the only male in the country that says that. But you know, and my girlfriend doesn't like football or Barry Manilow, so she went in to take an extended nap. And so I thought it was important to get that out in the open, just up front, to lose as many listeners as possible at the beginning of the show. But anyway, that's my embarrassing life today. We got a great show for you tonight. You want to get started on this, Jerry?
I do. I definitely want to get started.
Okay, let's do it. Our first guest tonight, Brian Garfield, is a highly accomplished author, screenwriter, and musician who wrote his first novel at the age of 18. More than 70 books later, he's still going strong, with roughly 20 million-plus copies of his works published worldwide and 17 feature films adapted from his vivid and versatile creations. He's won an Edgar Award for his novel Hopscotch, which he later translated into screenplay form for the highly regarded Walter Matthau film, and he's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in history. Throughout his illustrious and enduring career, he has inspired some of the biggest names in literature and cinema, including John Grisham, who claims that Garfield's tips for suspense writing were the primary keys to his own historic success. Perhaps his most popular work is Death Wish, which was memorably adapted into the hit series of Charles Bronson films by the same name. He's also the writer behind one of the most criminally overlooked suspense genre classics of the 80s, The Stepfather. I love that movie. Don't you love that movie?
Oh, that's a great film.
That is a fantastic film. And the latest film, based on his work, is director James Wan's Death Sentence, starring Kevin Bacon. It is a great pleasure to welcome Brian Garfield to our show. Let me bring up the line, I'm sorry. Mr. Garfield, are you there?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the flattery.
Yeah.
No, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for being there.
I'm very excited to have you on because I've been wanting to kind of explore the novelist's love-hate, or, you know, oftentimes I'm sure it's hate-hate relationship with the Hollywood machine. But first, you wrote your first novel at the age of 18. That's amazing.
Yeah, I was in the Army at the time and didn't have any better to do.
Yeah. Well, what keeps you going after all these years? What is it about the process of writing that you love so much?
Well, you just hope that the one you're working on now is better than the ones that went before.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I don't write the same thing twice, except in the case of Death Wish, for which I wrote a sequel that never got filmed until this year.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. But, you know, I hear writers talk about the rewards of crafting a novel as opposed to writing screenplays. But are there any creative rewards for crafting a screenplay that you don't find in novel writing or narrative writing?
It's short. I mean, a screenplay is about the length of a long short story.
Right.
But it has to be... You have to be really careful with it because you can't waste any words. I don't know. A novel or a nonfiction, any kind of book, is your own. You know, you wrote it. It's your fault. It's also your credit. Whereas a movie is made by hundreds of people.
Right.
Or dozens if it's an independent film. But in any case, it isn't the writers. You know, producers and directors can claim movies as their own. Writers only if they also produce and or direct.
Uh-huh.
And I've only done that a couple of times, and it's very hard work producing, and it takes an awful lot of time, you know, getting a film made from ground zero.
You're a co-producer on Hopscotch, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that film.
Yeah, I love it, too. It was just great fun once we finally got it going, but it took, like, I think 6 years, and... I think I was on the 26th draft of the screenplay when we filmed, because we started with Warren Beatty. And it moved around a little bit.
Warren Beatty was attached to Hopscotch at the beginning?
Yeah, he was going to produce it and star in it with Jane Fonda.
Oh, wow.
And,
oh, my God, that would have been very different.
Yeah, well, it was a fascinating project. And then he found something else to do. He had a quarrel with Warner Brothers, and so that just fell apart, and we went back to starting over, and I'd been pestered for years by an independent producer named Eli Landau, who had produced a number of good movies like The Pawnbroker and so forth. And
great film.
Eli said, "Well, when you get tired of trying to be a hotshot producer, bring it back to me." And finally, I went to him and said, "How would you like to go partners on this?" And he said, "Okay, let's do it."
Hmm.
And he got Walter to come in and agree to do it. And once you have a star, it's much easier to commit everybody else.
Yeah, it's hard to get better than Walter Matthau, too.
Yeah.
Wow, what a body.
Walter was just so much fun to work with, you know.
Mm-hmm. I bet. When they take when they adapt these works of yours, have you had to kind of learn to let go of your baby in a sense? Do you kind of have to distance yourself from it?
In some cases you do. In other cases, it's amazing how close they are to the book. I mean, Hopscotch was the same story as the book, but it was a comedy. The book is not a comedy. It's just a suspense thriller.
Right.
And we figured, we're going to do this again. Let's make it funny, you know. I don't write screenplays for my own books normally because, you know, you had a reason for doing everything you did in the book, and often those reasons don't apply with a movie, but you're too close to it to realize that.
Sure.
And oddly enough, Death Sentence is a case where I did the first couple of drafts of the screenplay, and before I even started, the producers and I sat down, and we all said the same thing, which is, you know, this book was written in the 70s as a sequel to an existing story, and we're not producing it as a sequel to anything, and it's dated, you know. let's do a new story.
Right.
So we started with the idea of doing a new story, which made the same point. The point really being that you know, vigilante violence is really attractive as a fantasy, and we've all had that fantasy.
Right.
Frequently. And it's great on the screen. The problem is when you try to put it into actual practice, it's bound to hurt everybody connected with it.
Uh-huh.
Not just the bad guys, you know.
Right.
And I think the movie brings that out beautifully. I mean, Kevin Bacon is just astonishing, and I think he follows that whole arc down into madness.
Yeah, I agree with that. I found that to be the case, especially the effects, I mean, obviously on his family in the film.
Yeah,
it is a concept of vigilantism that really it's ripe with drama and conflict and you know, certain ambiguity. What about it spoke to you when you set out to write Death Wish many years ago?
I had been the victim of a very minor crime. You know, somebody had slashed the top of my old convertible, which probably wouldn't have been very traumatic because I'd already bought a new top. The car was 10 years old, and I just hadn't bothered to put it on yet. The problem was I had a two-hour drive through a snowstorm to get home that night from where it was slashed in New York. I was mad, you know. I thought, well, I'll kill the son of a bitch. You know, that was my first thought. My second thought was, well, wait a minute, he's got a knife because he had to have something that he slashed the top with.
Right.
I don't really want to meet this guy.
Right.
But by the time I got home, I was half frozen, and I'm thinking, well, I'm okay. I'm home now, you know. But what if somebody got mad and stayed mad?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just didn't come out of that temporary insanity. And that was the genesis of the book,
mm-hmm.
of Death Wish, I mean, the original book. The death sentence was a kind of penance for the movie of Death Wish, not for the
book.
Yeah,
you're pretty vocal in your dislike of the film Death Wish, weren't you?
Well, Wendell Mays wrote the screenplay, and it is a brilliant screenplay. I say that at the risk of exposing myself because it follows the book very closely. But the problem was that it was originally slated to be directed by Sidney Lumet in black and white with Jack Lemmon.
Ooh.
Whoa.
That's a completely different film, right?
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. It probably wouldn't have been as popular, and it probably wouldn't have spawned those sequels, but, you know, it was really a nice script, and I was looking forward to seeing the movie, and then unfortunately the producers went broke. They had released a film that they had put all their money into that didn't do any box office. And that is the danger that many independent producers face. The smart ones are the ones who go out and raise money from other people and don't use their own. But I don't know. Anyway, they had to sell two properties that were ready to go, and one of them was Death Wish, the other was Serpico, and I had worked on that also.
Oh, you worked on Serpico as well?
Yeah, well, I was Frank Serpico's first ghostwriter because we lived near each other, and you know, I was the only writer he knew.
Oh, goodness.
And I just got too... I really became scared because I didn't know how to authenticate any of the things he was telling me. You know, I'm not a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I have learned how to do my research since then, but in those days, this was back in the 70s, early 70s, I had no idea how to go and find, you know, confirmation for anything he was telling me.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a bit nutty, you know, he's a kind of obsessive guy, and I wasn't sure whether
he's
all
very colorful,
true.
Yeah.
And he's a marvelous character, he's a great guy, but anyway... we went to the New York Times, and they put him together with Peter Moss, who did a wonderful book, you know, and then that was, again, turned into a wonderful script.
It's a big regret of ours here on the show, because we recently did a two-hour tribute to Al Pacino, and we came so close to getting Mr. Serpico on.
Just
couldn't schedule it.
That's a shame. Cause
yeah,
he,
that would have
really,
been great.
He's a brilliant talker, among other things. I mean, he's got stories up to here, and the marvelous, I was on the set a few times while they were filming Serpico, you know, every chance he got, Pacino would go and sit with Frank Serpico and just study him. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And he got him. I mean, that person in the movie isn't Al Pacino, it's Frank Serpico.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
He just had him cold. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sidney Lumet, speaking of him, he seems like I mean, he's obviously an actor's director, but he seems to treat the writer as king. You know, he seems to have a respect for the writer.
I think that a lot of the directors who came out of early television are that way.
Yeah.
They had to do these live television shows, and they didn't have time to improvise new lines or anything. You know, they figured, that here's the script, this is what we're doing.
And, yeah, do you find that 2 hours a little more rare now?
And then you had to go in front of the camera and do the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was live.
Yeah, is that more and more rare now?
I think it is, because that generation is slowly disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Frankenheimer and Lumet, and, I mean, there were dozens of really good directors who came out of that era.
True.
Well, with Death Wish, I mean, it was a hugely popular film, and it inspired these sequels. And, you know, back to the love-hate relationship, I would imagine, you know, in spite of your kind of disliking of the product, it had to have opened additional opportunities for you.
It made a career for me. It was, you know, I was making a living as a writer, but I wasn't doing very terribly well. I had written some movies that didn't get produced, but that doesn't count for much either.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I was in Africa at the time when the movie came out. And it's also the summer when Nixon resigned, and I hadn't even heard about that because I was way back in the bush someplace.
Mm.
And finally I came back to, I think it was Nairobi, and there was a cable waiting for me, several days old, from my agent saying, how does it feel to be a star? I didn't know what he was talking about. And all I was seeing was these newspapers with the headlines about Nixon resigning. You know?
Right.
And when I got back to New York, I took my father-in-law to see the picture in Times Square. And it had been running for 6 or 7 weeks by then.
Hmm.
And it was amazing. I mean, this is an afternoon, you know, matinee performance. And the theater was packed, and there were people getting up on their seats and yelling, yeah, kill that guy.
Hmm.
I've never seen that kind of reaction to a movie. And, of course, I didn't expect it. I had seen the movie in a screening before we left for Africa. And my thought, I have to confess, was, well, it's another Bronson action movie, and the others have done okay, so this will probably do okay also. You know, The Mechanic and The Stone Killer movies.
Sure.
Like that.
Yeah, and The Veloci Papers. And
pardon?
The Veloci Papers, right? Didn't he do that?
I don't remember if he did that before or after, but
right.
he might have done it either. It doesn't matter. The one I remember was The Mechanic.
Yeah, that's a good movie. The big one from that time.
And Mr. Majestic, which nobody remembers. But
oh, that's a great film.
Elmore Leonard wrote that.
Yeah, that's a wonderful film.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what in your estimation, did the film version of Death Sentence get right that Death Wish did not?
Well, the movie of Death Wish, I think it's an exciting movie. I mean, God knows they wouldn't have made all those sequels if it weren't.
Right.
The problem with it is that it ends on an upbeat note in which you're supposed to regard this character as the cowboy who cleaned up New York.
Mm.
And that wasn't my point in writing the book. My point was, and I'd written a lot of Westerns, and I'd sort of studied the subject, and, you know, you go around shooting people, somebody's going to shoot you. That's the bottom line.
Right.
You know?
It's a circle of violence.
Yeah, it's he who lives by the sword, you know. And it's true. I mean, it isn't just mythology.
Do you find, though, when was the year the Death Wish came out? It was
74.
74.
Yeah.
Do you find that a movie like that it kind of thrives based on the political climate of the time? People.
I think so. I didn't think so at the time because it didn't occur to me, but now, you know, we're having a spate of vigilante films again with
The
Brave One coming out next week, and there's another small independent film that's been running for several weeks now. And they're not exactly vigilante movies. They're revenge films. There is a difference. You know, vigilante is a guy who goes out to clean up the town no matter who the bad guys are.
Right.
The revenge picture has to do with getting revenge on somebody who has personally injured you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Death Sentence is, and that's what The Brave One is. So I don't know whether vigilante is an accurate...
No, you're right. They are more revenge than vigilante. Yeah.
But they're revenge action thrillers, whether you want to call them vigilantes or not.
Yeah.
And there's a spate of them coming out right now. And, you know, my theory, which is just my theory, but it's that we feel we've lost control again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 70s, there was this sense of crime in the streets, and everybody was afraid to walk around New York. I walked around New York all the time. Nobody mugged me. But it was just a sense, you know, it was a publicity sense that the cities were unsafe.
Right.
And today, I think we don't so much feel that our cities are unsafe, but we feel the world is unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
We can't do anything about it because we have this bunch of idiots in Washington.
Right?
And I'm talking about all parties, you know.
Yeah.
You could not be more right.
Yeah. I mean...
Yeah, there's such a discontent in the world now, and it's interesting to see how our arts reflect that.
It is.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But to the state of the novel, in this day and age, you know, we have nonstop television and video games and other media. What are your thoughts on the current state of the novel?
Oh, it's surprisingly healthy. You know, I mean, more books are being sold and presumably read than ever before in history, which is surprising considering the amount of competition they have now from other media.
Yeah.
And I don't have any trouble selling books. And I like doing books. I like writing books because they're yours.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
I mean, if you got it wrong, it's your own fault. But if you got it right, then you're not going to have to wait until... Charles Bronson gets fan mail and forwards it.
Speaking of Death Sentence, did you have any interaction with James Wan during the process?
I didn't, but in fact, the first contact I've had with him was after I saw the film.
Oh.
And I just wrote him a little note and said, you know, this is a marvelous piece of work. I really think it's an outstanding directorial job, and the fact that he's only made two movies before is astonishing to me, because it's such a mature work.
Yeah, and definitely in Kevin Bacon, who is so good at playing those everyman roles.
Yeah, he did a really good job, I felt.
Yeah.
I thought he was great, and John Goodman just knocked me out of the park. He's so malevolent.
Mm-hmm.
He's so evil.
Oh, that scene
that
where they
funny.
Confront each other is classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me what's next.
I thought all of them were good. The whole cast was, you know.
Yeah. Oh, the Goodman and the gang leader. He was just frightening.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, what's the other movie he's in that's out right now? You know, he's a likable guy with a lot of hair.
Yeah, I know, but he's not in this one.
No, he's
the evil. He's the root of all evil in that one.
He's a fine actor, because anybody can bring that off and make you believe it is doing his job, you know.
I understand that there are currently plans to adapt your historical novel, The Manifest Destiny.
Yeah, that's been kicking around it was published in 90, I think, or maybe 89. So it's been around a long time, but... the same producers who did Death Sentence have it, and I hope they do it, because they did Ray, you know, the Ray Charles film.
Oh, okay.
They're good filmmakers, and I'm looking forward to it being done. There's an excellent screenplay by Kirk Ellis, and I just hope to see it done. I'm sort of following their efforts to do it either as a 4-hour miniseries for cable or as a movie.
When I read it, that's what I thought. When I read that story that it was in development, that's the first thing that crossed my mind. And HBO, is that something that you guys are looking at in the miniseries form?
Yeah, they're talking to folks at HBO, and I don't know what stage those things are in, because I'm not really involved in the production, but I'd just love to see a movie of it, because it's about Theodore Roosevelt when he was a young man in the Wild West.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, I didn't make up stuff. It's,
oh, that would be very, that would be great to see.
Oh, you know.
Yeah, and tell me about your new book that came out just this past January.
It's almost impossible to explain. It's a nonfiction book. It's a biography. It's a corrective biography of a man who's been the subject of several previous biographies, all of whom got it wrong. His name was Richard Meinertzhagen, and that's very hard to pronounce.
Yeah, I didn't try to pronounce it. I was waiting for you to do it.
I'm sorry, what?
You notice I didn't try to pronounce it. I was waiting for
right,
you to...
Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, I wish he'd had a simpler name, you know, but he was an Englishman, in spite of the name. And he claimed a lot of things. He claimed he won the First World War and knocked out lots of communist cells around Europe in the 1930s, and then won the Second World War. The problem is a lot of people actually believed him. You know, Churchill was taken in, and Lawrence of Arabia, and it was just amazing how far he managed to push these hoaxes. And he also, at the same time, was the dean of British ornithology. He was their greatest natural scientist between the two wars. And it turns out that most of the birds that he allegedly collected were, well, they were collected, okay, but they were stolen. You know, most of them were stolen from museums, to which he then gave them back with great aplomb.
He sounds like the Ahmed Shalabi of the early 20th century.
Yeah. But, you know, what was amazing was not that the guy lied about his life. Everybody does a little bit. He did carry it to extremes, but still, it was the fact that everybody believed him.
Mm-hmm. What is
Very
it that
true.
They say, the bigger the lie, the more people believe it?
I guess that's true.
Yeah. And what is the name of that book again? I'm sorry.
Well, The Meinertzhagen Mystery. I won't spell it for you. It would take too long.
Well, we'll definitely be on the lookout for that. And Mr. Garfield, thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's
thank
been
you
a
very
terrific
much.
Pleasure.
Yeah. Keep going to the movies, guys.
Absolutely.
Will.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks much. Bye-bye.
That is Brian Garfield, a fantastic talent, a fantastic author. He's influenced so many people in the industry, and he's the author of Death Sentence, which is currently in release in theaters from director James Wan, starring Kevin Bacon. Interesting conversation.
Oh, yeah, without
a
doubt.
Yeah, fantastic. And I do wonder about that, like the authors. That's why I'm so glad that we had him on, because you know, it opens up opportunities to have an author's work adapted to film, but it has to be a painful process at times. Because
oh, I'm
they
sure of it.
Because there's so many cases where they basically rape your material.
Well, that was like John Grisham, I guess, a couple of years ago, because he got fed up. I don't know why, because I thought some of the movies, the early movies based on his work, were actually very entertaining, but he got up to a point where he had creative control over who could buy his work. And
right.
And he got very upset after a couple of films. He was very protective of his work now, so that's why we don't see that many adaptations.
Yeah, and when we spoke with Alison Burnett a few weeks ago, a screenwriter of Resurrecting the Champ and the upcoming Feast of Love, you know, we were asking about, is the clout and the voice of the screenwriter, is it a little bit more appreciated today in film, because you know people, the recent deal that a group of screenwriters made that really gives them unparalleled clout and say in how their work is developed. It's unheard of, and so it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, the writer has always been used to being the lowest one on the totem pole.
That's very true.
And you know, you can't imagine how that applies to the author, whose work is adapted into screenplay form.
Right.
You know, it must at times feel like a very helpless enterprise.
Yeah, no, and it's just very interesting. Who would have ever thought that one of the most famous revenge films, and the book is based on, because the author's the cover to his convertible was slashed.
Yeah, well, inspiration comes from...
it's amazing. It's neat.
I think that's the number one key to being a writer is probably to leave yourself open to those kinds of
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah, it is. Just a couple of notes. You can subscribe to our show by iTunes. I normally mention that at the beginning of the show, but I'll mention it now. If you look on the right-hand side of our Blog Talk Radio screen, you'll see the subscribe to iTunes icon. Click on that after the show, of course, and it'll take you to your iTunes page, and you can download absolutely free. Our past 6 or 7 podcasts are archived on there, and we have some great shows that we've done in the past few weeks, some big scoops, including a conversation with one of the stuntmen on Indiana Jones 4. That was a lot of fun.
That was great.
Yeah, it was. And we interviewed the director of Good Luck Chuck, Mark Helfrich. Help me out here. What else do we got? We have
We had the producer of Halloween.
Yes, a conversation with him. A great show.
That was an awesome show. We had Alison Burnett.
Yeah, and you can download all of these podcasts through iTunes. It's absolutely free, and it's a great service. Speaking of Halloween, are you ready?
Yes, I am ready.
This will be great. We all loved Halloween on this show. Last weekend, aided by the rabid appetites of millions of hardcore horror fans, Rob Zombie's Halloween smashed the record for the all-time best Labor Day opening weekend by a whopping 52%, and it's held strong in its second week of release to the tune of more than $44 million. This is the film everyone in America has been talking about. Our second guest tonight is one of the co-stars of this smash film. In just a few short years, she has crafted an impressive resume in theater, film, and television, collaborating with the likes of Spike Lee in She Hate Me, and Uma Thurman, Sam Shepard, and Isabella Rossellini in the upcoming film The Accidental Husband. On the small screen, she's contributed exceptional work in classic shows like Rescue Me and Law and Order. And not only has this multi-talented creative force spent time behind the camera as a budding documentary filmmaker, but she's also had extensive experience behind the mic, having worked as a radio DJ in New York for 4 years. It is a great pleasure to welcome this remarkable model, actress, and filmmaker to our show, Miss Christina Klebe. Christina, are you there?
I'm here. I didn't know it would go so easily.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've got to be thrilled. Halloween has been such a tremendous success. How does it feel to be a part of something this massive?
I purposely left the country when it came out because I was like, I just can't. I don't know how to deal with it. So it hasn't quite hit me yet. I just got back from Sicily 3 days ago, and since then I've actually been sick. So if I sound a little nasal, it's because I have a cold.
Oh, that's okay.
So it really hasn't hit me. I haven't even been out really. I'm in New York right now, and nobody really recognizes me. I'm like, well, like, what if somebody would just say, you know, is that Christina Klebe? And I'm like, you know, but it's New York, so nobody cares.
That's right. That's right. I want to talk more about Halloween, definitely. But first, tell me how you started into acting. How did it all begin for you?
Well, I guess as a child, I always loved being on stage. I kind of had an obsession with anytime there was a platform and I could get on it, I would be on it. So if you think about, you know, as a child, the fact that you already like being in front of people,
right.
I think that was really the beginning of it all. But as a professional, you know, understanding that I wanted to go into it as a profession, I would say it started in my late, you know, teens, 16, 15, 16, you know, I started doing theater off-Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, and but I still wasn't sure. I was like, well, I'll just go to college, you know, because I don't, you know, who knows? It's a difficult profession.
Yeah,
but
the voice of reason kind of.
and the voice of the parents.
Yes,
comes
yes.
in.
That's right.
You know, but yeah.
So how did this Halloween opportunity come up for you?
Well, it just came through a regular audition, which, you know, as much as you think that we all get a lot of auditions, I still go for weeks without having an audition sometimes. So I just went to an audition with a casting director that I had met before, and, you know, it was an untitled Rob Zombie project, and I had no idea at that point even, I mean, I knew who White Zombie was, but I didn't really connect the two. So I was
right.
like, okay, Rob Zombie, great. Who's Rob Zombie, and what is this project? All I know is that I have to die, and I get, you know, killed on camera, and my character says a lot of bad words. And so I just went in and auditioned, and I guess I did well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Are you a fan of the horror genre or of this particular original film in particular?
I'm starting to now get in more into horror. I mean, originally I was not. I'm not like a horror fanatic, somebody who knows all about, you know, the history of horror and all
right.
that, you know. But I have started watching a lot more, you know, like more old school horror, like you
mm-hmm.
know, Night of the Living Dead. And
mm-hmm.
I did watch the original Halloween, and I think it was amazing. I mean, I think it's a classic. It's classic. I love the older movies more than I do the new. You know,
Yeah, I agree with you, and this is what we're discussing. We had a long conversation about Halloween last weekend after we all saw it here on the show.
Yeah.
And we're all big fans of those horror films that came out of the 70s,
mm-hmm.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Halloween, and just classic films, and this one in its style and its execution, it feels like those. And that's what I appreciated so much about those. And they all seem to come from a discontent. You know, the best horror films seem to come from a discontent with the climate in the world at that time.
Which is ironic, though, still, because, you know, like, you think, like, showing more violence is kind of weird in a time of violence, right? Like, it seems, but you're right. I mean, it must come out of some kind of, maybe, to show how absurd it is or how, you know, scary it is. And
the best horror films of the early 70s, the late 60s, starting with Night of the Living Dead, like you mentioned, I mean, they're very inspired by that Vietnam era, you know, where people were just horrified. And it was, I don't know what it is, it's some form of some catharticism or something that they get from the movies, but
I think that's you just hit it right there. That's what it is.
Yeah, and Halloween, the original, was definitely, you know, Vietnam had ended, but it was definitely a part of that, and just told so well. And Zombie's new film is just incredible. Now, you said that you watched the original Halloween. Did you do that just prior to shooting this one?
No, I didn't. Originally, I watched Devil's Rejects before I met Rob and before we started shooting. And then I started watching, I rented the Halloween, and I was like, oh, you know, I should watch it, obviously. You know, it's, but I started watching it, and it was kind of, it was so different than what I thought his script was. Not that his script is so different, and obviously now everyone's seen it, so they understand, like, it didn't have the feel, like, it seemed much slower, the original Halloween, than Rob's script, even before the movie. Obviously, you see that it moves very quickly, and you know, he does get a lot in there. And so I just, and then the character, my character, I watched like this tiny little bit of the first scene, and I was like, oh, I don't know, like I just, I couldn't connect the two. I was like, they're just different. The way he wrote it was different, and I didn't want to be influenced by that. So
yeah, that could be kind of dangerous.
I mean, in one sense, it's very smart because you don't want, I actually kind of understand, you don't want to have, you want to come in fresh and do a fresh take of this.
So were you aware of the level of scrutiny this project would be under by the diehard fans of that original movie?
No, I didn't. And I didn't even until we finished shooting, because it wasn't until after we finished shooting that I started, like, looking on the internet, and I never even had, I had, like, a MySpace page that had, like, four friends, you know, and I never, you know, never really went on it, and suddenly, I think it was Scout that said, you know, you should really go on MySpace, or, you know, connect with Rob Zombie on MySpace, so I was like, oh, sure, I'll connect with Rob Zombie, and then all of a sudden, like, a world opened up to me, a world of what, you know, the fans are really, you know, I think the internet is a huge place for horror fans. And so I didn't realize until after we finished shooting and until I started getting into that world that, you know, there were things like, oh, my God, how many totallys does the Linda say? Or, you know, do you die the same way? And I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, if I had known this before, I might have added a few things in there. But
Very possessive over every little detail, aren't they? So that feeling didn't permeate the set at all of having to live up to or exceed people's expectations from that original film?
I don't think so. You know, maybe it's because I didn't know about it, so I didn't, like, have any, I didn't project anything, or I didn't, like, think people were thinking a certain way because I didn't know about it. But I think Rob probably also made a point of casting people that were new to the, well, he cast, I guess, a lot of cameos, but nobody from the original Halloween except for, you know, I guess from the Halloween series, Danielle, but I think he probably made a point to involve people that wouldn't, that would kind of shed a new light on it, on the project.
So tell me about Rob Zombie, the director. What were you expecting, and what surprised you most about him?
I was expecting the guy that's on his IMDb photo, which is like this guy that is like you know, has a hat on. You can't even see his face. He's just making a weird facial expression, like kind of like looks like he's snarling at you.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I don't, you know. So it was, that's what I was expecting. And when I met him the first time, he definitely has an incredible presence. So you can be intimidated, but once you start joking around with him and you kind of get a feel for who he is, he's just a really gentle, straightforward, honest kind of giving person. You know, he's great as a director because I think he really knows how to talk to actors. And
I get that from him from interviews.
Mm-hmm.
His enthusiasm
yeah.
is like no one else's
mm-hmm.
for the
seems
process.
Very
warmly
and surprisingly so. Yeah.
Yeah, and he has a very calm way of talking to actors. So, like, even if he wants something else from your performance, he doesn't dictate it. He kind of knows how to get it out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, it doesn't matter how much, you know, you've studied directing or studied, you know, gone to film school or whatever. If you don't know how to work with actors, you're kind of, I mean,
you
better just
it's
hope
true.
That the actors know how to do everything.
Right, right.
You know? But.
And it's obvious that he's a dynamite director. I mean, you can definitely tell from watching this film that it's the work of a true director.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about the mechanics of performing in a horror film, because I think that performers in this genre are so often underappreciated, just because of the nature of the genre. Just to sustain that level of high intensity in a performance is just mind-numbing to me.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of mood do you try to keep on the set? Do you try to keep it light between takes, or do you try to stay in that zone? What is that like?
It's interesting. I mean, I only had that one, you know, intense scene where, you know, we had that one day where we shot my death scene and, you know, the sex scene and whatever. And it was kind of, I guess you get to a certain place, like you don't really, at least for me, it was a little nerve-wracking to be in that situation. And so I guess you joke in between, but I think it brings you to a certain place, and you kind of have that in the back of your head.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might, like, you know, hopefully you're not, like, mean to people on set just because, you know, you're in a kind of zone. Like, I know there is, you know, people are like that sometimes, but I think you can just hopefully separate a little bit the two. You know, you have the in the back of your mind where your character is and maybe what your previous takes were like and that kind of intensity.
Right.
Then you need to just maybe go to the craft services and eat a little chocolate or a granola bar and, you know, stuff your face and, you know, and then make a joke and then go back and, you know, you kind of, you know, and every person has a different way of working, so.
Yeah, and your scene, the scene that you're talking about, I mean, it had to have been a very vulnerable kind of situation for you.
Yeah, it was very vulnerable, and, like, it's, you know, it's, I don't know, it makes you think, like, I've never done nudity in a film before, and it makes me not want to do it again because, you know, people are like, oh, you know, I don't know, it's just weird. I mean, I never, you know, it's not so much the death, it's more the nudity.
Right.
Me.
Oh, absolutely.
You
but
know?
But speaking of the death, we'll get off the nudity. Let's get on the death.
Yeah, exactly.
Some people say in a love scene where it's not sexy because you're concerned with the mechanics of it and
mm-hmm.
what goes where. But when you're doing a frightening scene,
mm-hmm.
how do you know if it's working? Is it palpable? I mean, can you feel it, or is there such a disconnect with what?
I think you can totally feel it. I mean, and to tell you the truth, I mean, there were takes that we shot of my death scene. The first, like, three takes where I was completely nude, which you don't see, you know, in the movie, but I was so just thinking about the fact that I was naked.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, and there were, like, only men that I knew that my death was not as realistic as I think, it would have been if I had just, I had started off in a different place.
Right.
But then once we got past my feeling nervous about that or... then I think they got better. The takes got better, and I think you can feel that as an actor. You can feel when it is more realistic. And
mm-hmm.
I don't even think they used the take that I think is the best in the movie. Like, there was one take where we were like, where I was struggling, and you know, as we got more into it, Rob was like, well, just, you know, say like kind of like fight him off and, like, you know, say something to him. And so I just started going off, like, well, what are you doing? You know, what, get your hand, you know, like, and there were words, and it was really super intense, but I don't know why they didn't use that.
Hmm.
I hope that's on, like, the outtakes or something.
I bet it will be.
Hopefully.
That's our deleted scene.
Yeah, I bet this is going to be a big DVD.
Yeah, I bet it will be too.
I can't wait.
You know what I appreciated about the movie too? I appreciated the fact that the three girls, yourself and Scout and Danielle, they felt like teenagers. You know, they didn't feel like 30-year-olds trying to pass off as teenagers in so many of these movies.
Yeah.
Tell me about working with the two of them.
Well, I mean, it was great. We kind of met, and right away we kind of knew we were in for this. Like, so we kind of just got right into friendship mode. It was weird. Like, I mean, I don't know if it's that, I mean, I know Rob did a great job casting it, but then also as an actor, you're like, we are going to be these three friends, so that's what we're going to be, you know? And you just kind of go for it. And we all did really get along, and we had a lot of fun, but we wouldn't, you know, we hung out a few times afterwards, but we weren't like hanging out all the time, like off set or, you know, when we weren't shooting. It was kind of just, we got there and we felt the energy, and we did it. And I've gotten that. I've gotten a lot of people who've said, you know, it was amazing. You guys seemed like you were just best friends. Like,
right, right.
And we didn't really know each other that well. I think that's just something that happens if you get good actors together who, and there's a good chemistry between people, and you know what your job is. You just, there was a really weird thing, though. I always, for some reason, used to grab Scout's butt. I don't know why, but like in every scene, I was always like grabbing her ass. Excuse me. And like, and just at a certain point, she was like, "Why do you keep on doing that, Christina?" And I was like, "I have no idea. Like, I don't. There's no reason why I should feel that comfortable with you. There's like on a personal level." But for some reason, as Linda, like, it just came out. And I would always be like, and she must have, I think she for a while thought I was a lesbian. She was just like, well, I don't know what this girl's deal is, but, you know.
Is that anyway. In the movie?
You don't really see, there's one scene where we're walking on the street, and you can kind of see me, like, I kind of, it's the three of us, and I kind of, my hand is behind her, and she kind of jumps. And she kind of jumps forward, and that's what I'm doing. So
well, that's another part to look out for in the DVD.
Yeah, so when you go to see it another time,
right,
everybody.
Right. Danielle in particular had to have a lot of stories about working on this series with her history. Did you get a sense that this was kind of coming full circle for her?
Yeah, I guess so. But because I didn't know so much about the series, it wasn't like something that I really talked to her about.
Yeah.
You know, like, I guess, like I said, you know, when you know things, then you can go into the history. But she, to me, came more out of, I knew she was a child actor.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would just talk about other things, like tattoos and, like, where she had a tattoo or, you know, like, or, you know, pole dancing, which she loves to do. So, I don't know. We would talk about, like, you know, more... Sometimes it's weird talking about people, actors' history, because you don't really, like, you weren't there for that. So,
yeah.
It's like you want to be in the moment, in the present, and, like, understand where they're coming from. Or anybody, I think, right? When you're
right.
talking to them, like, where they are today, like, on the set, sitting on, you know, at the table, eating lunch, or, you know?
Right. I know you said that you kind of fled the country upon the film's release, but have you had a chance? I know you probably attended the premiere with the cast and crew and assorted industry.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to watch it in the theater with a regular audience?
No, and you know what? I was going to go just this afternoon with my mother because she hasn't seen it yet. I took my dad to the premiere, so he saw it. But I haven't seen, my mother hasn't seen it, so I was just going to go, and then because I was a little sick, I was like, oh, you know, I'm just going to... I bailed, and I haven't been able to.
Well,
it'll
be playing for a long time.
Yeah.
So you have plenty of time to.
How about this? I have a few friends, and that are a little scared of horror movies.
Uh-huh.
And so they've all requested that I go with them, so that they realize it's not like
not
real.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sure I'll have my chance.
Tell me about these. I needed to ask this. I've always been curious about it. These screenings, these big premiere screenings that they have, they consist mostly of industry people, correct?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, pretty much.
So when they watch a movie, are they so jaded from being in that industry and knowing how everything works and all the tricks and tools that they can't appreciate it like a regular audience would, or do you find it the opposite?
I think it's different. I think they have a different kind of appreciation. I personally, I mean, my guests included one very prominent producer who his movie, I'm just going to promote it for him because he's, you know, a really great guy. It's In the Valley of Elah,
yeah,
which is coming out in 2 weeks with Charlize Theron. And so although you should all go see Halloween again, you should go see In the Valley of Elah, too.
Absolutely.
He was there, and so obviously he knows a lot about movies. And he looked at it from a point of view maybe of a producer and said, this movie is going to do really well. He said, because even I'm not a big horror fan, but he's like, I was on the edge of my seat, and I really appreciated it from many levels of a film. So, you know, you get a different perspective more than maybe a general like audience that is just going to enjoy the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can, you know, I think people still do appreciate it. In the industry, and you know.
So you have an interest in filmmaking yourself.
Yeah.
What do you take from directors like Rob Zombie and you? I know you've worked with Spike Lee and you just did the new movie with Isabella Rossellini. And what do you take from those creative talents? What tools have you taken from them?
It's weird because my filmmaking is much more documentary. I still look at them as like. I'm like, wow, like how do they use such big equipment, you know?
Right.
Because I don't work with like 35 millimeter.
Right, right.
You know, I've done 16 millimeter filmmaking, which is still a much smaller camera. And mostly what I get is when they do behind the scenes footage, like in interviews, which they did a lot of in Halloween. So I was always talking to the guy who did the documentary stuff, and I was like following him around. You know, I was like, so who are you going to interview next? And like, it was interesting to see how they covered the production of Halloween, because I definitely am much more into documentary filmmaking from my end of being behind the camera.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to me. What I learned from those directors, though, I think, you know, Griffin Dunne, Rob Zombie, Tom DeSillo, they all are very into improv, you know, as filmmakers. Like, they like when actors take things and go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love that. Like, if I can ad-lib some stuff here and there, I mean, that is the biggest gift a director can give. So it's interesting to see how they work or how they balance that, you know, so I guess that's from an acting standpoint. So.
Well, and it's all about facilitating, you know, what they call the happy accident, you know, that that moment of life that just sparks, you know.
Exactly.
That's what's so great about documentaries. And we've interviewed many documentary filmmakers, and that's what's great about it, because you just experience real life in a way that you oftentimes just can't get from narrative filmmaking.
And it's hard too in documentaries, because you know sometimes the people you have to find the right moments and the right people also, because some people just don't want to be in front of the camera.
Right.
So you're trying to capture a real moment, but they're really inhibited. So you also have to find the right stories and the right characters.
Yeah, and the best documentaries are just fantastic journeys for me. And a lot of my favorite films are documentaries. Are you there?
Oh, and now I'm here.
Okay.
For a second.
So we'll close this out, but tell me about your new movie. Is The Accidental Husband the next one for you?
Yeah, that's coming out in February. And, you know, I have a small part. I play Lini's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny, like, I mean, I speak German in it, and, you know, we're all like, it's great. It was great working with Uma Thurman. It was just honestly such a stellar, amazing cast that it was.
It really is, yeah.
It was great to work with them. Hopefully it'll do well. In
February.
That's in February.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You.
We really
thank
appreciate
you
taking the time out. And,
no problem.
Best of luck to you.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
That is
Bye.
Christina Klebe. She's a co-star of the new movie Halloween, fantastic actress, and she's got a great career ahead of her. Really big film in February, too.
I know. That's like back-to-back. I mean,
incredibly talented people, you know, and it just makes you better, you know.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, part of the reason why, this is what I always say about Tom Cruise, part of the reason why he's so assured of an actor, now is because he learned from the best. He made it a point to learn from the best.
No, I mean, you just look early on, like The Color of Money, Rain Man,
yeah.
A Few Good Men. I mean, he just constantly was surrounded by the best that you could be surrounded by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so fantastic. Christina's performance in Halloween is fantastic, and the movie's fantastic. And just if you haven't seen that yet, just race out and go see it. It's a great horror movie in a genre that is so often abused and don't really produce very many good movies anymore. Halloween is a real standout. Are you ready for Flick Picks of the Week, Jerry?
I'm kind of ready. Why don't you go first?
Okay. My Flick Pick of the Week this week is not a film, but a TV series that premieres its sixth, I think it's the sixth season.
I think you were right.
I'm speaking, of course, of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is the funniest show, for me, the funniest show in the history of television. And Larry David is the funniest real-life, I guess, character in the history of television.
He's crazy.
It is cringe-worthy comedy.
Always.
Yeah, if you're a fan of the uncomfortable comedy, you know, like The Office kind of squared, this is that's Curb Your Enthusiasm for you. And it looks like another cringeworthy season starting tonight.
And that starts tonight at 10 o'clock on HBO, right?
10 o'clock Eastern on HBO, so check that out. And then check out Barry Manilow at 9 o'clock on QVC.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah. You knew I couldn't resist.
I knew.
So how about you, man?
Okay, mine, last night I was very lucky to see the new Richard Gere movie, The Hunting Party.
Oh, wow.
And I just, you know, it's, you know, Richard Shepard directed this.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a movie before this called
The Matador.
With Pierce Brosnan, which is very good.
Yeah.
And I have to say, this film, I was hooked from the moment it started. Richard Gere and Terrence Howard play, respectively, a news reporter and a cameraman who have a very long history of working together in, like, the worst trouble spots in the world. And this takes place in the Balkans in the year 2000, after the war has, 5 years after the war has ended. And Richard Gere claims that he can get an interview and find out where this infamous Bosnian war criminal, Serbian war criminal, the Fox is.
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing about this is I had to, while I'm watching this, go back and rethink what I thought of Richard Gere in the film The Hoax, which I liked, but I wrote a very jokingly kind of review about.
Right.
But I did like the film and his performance. Well, I think 2007 is going to be remembered as the year that Richard Gere made two good films and playing the same kind of character, this kind of trickster character.
You know, ever since Unfaithful, Adrian Lyne movie. Ever since Unfaithful, he's really been on a hot streak.
That's very true. He has, but you know, he had Chicago, he had the Mothman Prophecies. Yeah, he. I don't know about the Mothman Prophecies, but Chicago though, and The Hoax, and this film though. I was really, and I'm very interested in the subject matter. But what I liked about the film more than anything else is you believe that him and Terrence Howard, from the moment the film opens, they had this long relationship.
Yeah.
And that you believe that these guys have been through, like, thick and thin together. But who's also very good is Jesse Eisenberg from The Squid and the Whale.
Right.
And he's very good. I'd actually have to say he steals some of the scenes he's in from both of them.
Hmm.
So
I've read raves about this. I just read the Entertainment Weekly review of it, gave it a B+.
That's about right. No, but it is. I think it's worth people's time. It's very entertaining.
All right, The Hunting Party, and that's in limited release
now.
Right?
It's in limited release. I saw it was a sneak preview in my area, and it should open on Friday wider.
Okay, so we'll definitely be on the lookout for that. That does look like a great film, and I've heard that it's probably a big awards contender. Speaking of awards, we haven't had time to discuss the Venice Film Festival, but we'll pay a little lip service to that next Sunday, because this Wednesday we have a packed show. It's possibly going to be an hour and a half long with Joe Pantoliano and Joseph Greco, the star and the director of Canvas, which opens in October, and Christy Jacobson, the director of Toots, which opened Friday in New York, and Adam Green, the director of Hatchet, the much-talked-about horror movie.
We hope it goes wider.
We hope it goes wider. It's
yeah.
in between, like, 30 to 50 theaters right now, I think, around the country. And it's going to grow because the buzz on this film is just deafening.
So
Adam Green will be here as well on Wednesday. Huge show, the biggest show in Movie Geeks United history.
It is. It's enormous.
Following the biggest weekend in Movie Geeks
United
history. And then next week, Blog Talk Radio enjoys what would you say?
Isn't it the one-year anniversary?
No, it's the refurbishing of the site. With
features.
All of our shows will be archived. All 30 of them will be archived and ready to play, and a lot of exciting chat rooms and stuff that you can correspond with us during the show. That might be dangerous.
Yeah, I know, really. That could be very dangerous.
Yeah, but anyway, great show tonight, and we will see you back here Wednesday night, guys.
All right, good night, everyone.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.